In 1960, a man stepped off a bus in Buenos Aires, carrying a briefcase and looking every bit the tired factory worker returning home. His neighbors knew him as Ricardo Clement, a quiet German immigrant who worked at Mercedes-Benz. But Ricardo Clement was a fiction. The real man was Adolf Eichmann, architect of the Holocaust's logistics, responsible for orchestrating the deaths of millions. What makes this story eternally unsettling isn't that monsters walk among us, it's that they look so achingly ordinary. Eichmann didn't have fangs or wild eyes. He was methodical, polite, even mundane. This is precisely why his capture and the story of the man who caught him matters so profoundly today. Peter Malkin, the Israeli agent who would eventually seize Eichmann with his bare hands, understood this ordinariness better than most. His journey to that fateful night began in a Polish shtetl, where fear was the daily currency of Jewish life. His earliest memories centered on his sister Fruma, her blue eyes, her maroon kerchief, the way she'd comfort him after falls. She stayed behind when his family fled to Palestine in 1933. She would later perish in the machinery Eichmann built with such bureaucratic precision. Palestine in the 1930s offered no refuge. Peter's family arrived to dust and British police no friendlier than those they'd fled. Crammed into a tiny room by a contemptuous relative lecturing about socialist Zionism, young Peter learned survival meant adaptation. By 8, he was cocky and fearless outside, while remaining the sensitive shtetl child within. At 9, Peter was recruited into the Haganah, the underground Jewish army. Too young for weapons, he learned codes, signals, and hiding techniques, memorizing routes that could mobilize hundreds within an hour. Being entrusted with life or death secrets as a child planted seeds that would bloom decades later when facing down history's most notorious bureaucrat of death. Meanwhile, Adolf Eichmann grew up in austere Germany under a stern father who emphasized order above all. When his mother died at 10, he felt little, an emotional flatness that would become his defining characteristic, the void where conscience should have lived. Eichmann's path to infamy began with mundane ambition. After losing his oil company job during the Depression, he joined the SS and endured brutal training he later boasted eliminated his susceptibility to pain. By 1935, he was running a Jewish museum, collecting data on German Jews. He became the Nazi expert on Jewish affairs, even visiting Palestine in 1937 to study the community he would later destroy. When Germany annexed Austria in 1938, Eichmann's moment arrived. At 32, he was assigned to make his homeland Judenrein, Jew-free. His method revealed chilling genius. First, terrorize Vienna's 183,000 Jews through beatings and humiliation, then present himself as reasonable and sympathetic. He would recite Zionist history to Jewish leaders while systematically stripping them of everything. Each person entering his emigration office left with only a passport marked J, valid for 2 weeks to find a foreign visa or face the concentration camps. Now living in the Rothschild mansion, driven in their limousine, he took an elegant mistress, the first of 9 throughout Europe. His demeanor alternated between charm and calculated fury, keeping Jewish leaders in constant terror. What's most disturbing is how he viewed himself, not as evil, but as an efficient administrator solving a logistical problem, millions dying while he saw only transportation schedules and deportation quotas. Less than a month after Germany invaded Poland, the Eichmann Authority was born. He mandated yellow stars for Jews over 6, forced them into ghettos under penalty of death, and traveled across Europe ensuring no exceptions to the final solution. When questions arose about groups like the Krimchaks, he decreed their elimination for safety's sake. His subordinate described him as not immoral, he was amoral and completely ice cold. Hungary became his crowning achievement. Its 800,000 Jews had remained beyond Nazi reach for 5 years, a personal affront. In spring 1944, he rushed to Budapest feigning reasonableness. "I am not an adherent of violence, but any opposition will be broken." Within 6 weeks, mass deportations began. By July, over 437,000 had been deported. When Hungary's regent halted deportations with Russians advancing, Eichmann returned in October to organize forced marches, claiming over 300,000 lives. Even as the Reich collapsed, he pressed for destruction of remaining prisoners. In April 1945, as allies closed in, he attempted leading a guerrilla unit into the Austrian Alps before disappearing down a mountain trail. What drives someone to prioritize genocide over self-preservation? This question would haunt Peter Malkin during their later encounters. By 1947, the Western Allies abandoned hunting Nazi fugitives, prioritizing Cold War concerns. The Haganah infiltrated Eichmann's wife's household in Austria, but learned nothing. Eichmann escaped American capture twice. As Otto Henninger, he worked as a lumberjack for 4 years before the Nazi underground provided new documents as Ricardo Clement and arranged passage through Italy to Argentina, facilitated by a Franciscan monk with a Vatican refugee passport. Then came an ironic twist. In 1957, a blind German-Jewish Holocaust survivor in remote Argentina grew suspicious when his daughter mentioned knowing Nicholas Eichmann in Buenos Aires. When she visited Nicholas's home, she met a balding, middle-aged man who uncomfortably acknowledged being the father. The blind man wrote to Dr. Fritz Bauer, a Holocaust survivor and German prosecutor who, dubious about his own government's resolve, passed the tip to Israel. A blind man saw what countless intelligence agencies missed. Sometimes, justice depends on unlikely circumstances and ordinary individuals refusing to look away. When Peter Malkin's superior asked, "You ever been to South America?" followed by, "We're going to Argentina to bring back Adolf Eichmann," Malkin was stunned. He would lead a team whose motivation was intensely personal. Every member except their commander had lost immediate family in the Holocaust. Studying Eichmann's file shook Malkin. Conferences determining how long different categories of Jews should live, coldness toward pleas from German-Jewish war heroes, and parents begging for their children, calculated cruelty designed to strip the doomed of their dignity. On May 11, 1960, after days of surveillance, Malkin and his team positioned a disabled Mercedes on Garibaldi Street. When Eichmann's bus arrived, Malkin lunged forward, grabbing him around the neck while whispering, "Un momentito, señor," to avoid alerting neighbors. At the safe house, Eichmann finally admitted his true identity. Against regulations, Malkin began private conversations, asking the fundamental question, "How did it happen? How did you come to do what you did?" Eichmann's response was chillingly matter-of-fact. "It was a job I had. I had a job to do." During their conversations, Eichmann revealed disturbing contradictions. He claimed he was never anti-Semitic and had always been fond of Jews. He boasted about reading Herzl, studying Zionism, even learning Hebrew with a rabbi. To Malkin's shock, he recited the Shema Yisrael prayer. When Malkin mentioned words like Abba and Ima, what Jewish children screamed when torn from their parents, Eichmann responded with chilling simplicity. "Yes, but he was Jewish, wasn't he?" He insisted he never personally killed anyone. "I was involved in collection and transport." When he compared their missions, Malkin explained the fundamental difference. "We didn't come here to kill you. We came to bring you to justice." These conversations changed Malkin profoundly. He realized perfectly normal-seeming people could be emotionally dead, beyond the reach of human feeling. Eichmann's evil wasn't expressed through sadistic pleasure, but through bureaucratic efficiency and moral blindness. On May 20, Malkin disguised Eichmann as an LL crew member, complete with a uniform bearing the Star of David. Guards waved them through without checking papers. They later learned Eichmann's son had mobilized local fascists to search for him, missing the plane by just half an hour. At Eichmann's 1961 trial in Jerusalem, their eyes suddenly locked. Eichmann was the only person there who knew who Malkin was. Under cross-examination about murdering 100 Jewish children, Eichmann claimed he did not remember, insisting he only handled transport. The truth was more chilling. Eichmann truly didn't understand he'd done wrong. He considered himself honorable, even complimenting his captors on their elegant job. When asked if the Holocaust could happen again, Melkin resisted giving reassurance. He pointed to Cambodia, Uganda, and events closer to home as evidence to the contrary. For decades, countless Nazis lived openly in communities where people knew exactly who they were, yet few came forward. Perhaps this is the most important legacy of Malkin's extraordinary mission, not just that justice was served, but that it forces us to confront uncomfortable questions about human nature. Evil doesn't announce itself with horns and pitchforks. It arrives in a business suit, carrying a briefcase, speaking the language of efficiency and duty. The question isn't whether it could happen again. The question is, are you watching closely enough to recognize it when it does?